I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 276th installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek, old and new. And tonight we are talking with Star Trek author David Mack, who just had a new book, Star Trek Picard Firewall, released this week. And Dave, this is a first for us. We've never actually talked to a Star Trek author. We've talked about the books, but we've never talked to someone who's written one.
That's true. And I think we've talked about the comics, and we've talked to the like the editor at IDW.
Yeah, but Heather Antos. Yeah.
Yeah. But novels are new to us. And we've talked about this a little before, but like I grew up originally reading a fair number of Trek novels in the '80s and some in the '90s. So I've kind of had a foot in Trek books forever.
Yeah, it's been a long staple of the fandom, going all the way back to, you know, like the early 70s, I guess, and help propping the franchise up when we can't always get the on-screen material we want. There's plenty of Star Trek on paper, so without any further ado, let's bring out one of these Star Trek authors. We are going to talk to the one and only David Mack. So, David, how the hell are you?
Doing pretty good. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good, and it's an exciting week. We have a new Star Trek novel to read. So,
oh yeah, there you go.
He might know something about it. How many Trek novels have you written?
I think, if I remember correctly, Firewall is my 31st Star Trek novel.
Wow,
that's a big Star Trek number. You know, 31 and all.
It makes me, at this point, I am the third most prolific author of Star Trek novels in the history of the franchise. Number two is Michael Jan Friedman, who is one ahead of me at 32. Mm-hmm. And number one, unassailable, is Peter David with 45 Star Trek novels to his credit. Of course, in my defense, they were writing back in the 90s and the early aughts when Star Trek was producing two books a month, 24 books a year.
Wow.
Now they only do five or six. It's a lot harder to get on the schedule and rack up credits over the last several years. So if I had started 10 years earlier, who knows? Who knows where I'd be?
there's time yet to catch up.
Well, not as much time as you think, and not enough time to catch up on 45.
Right.
I'm hoping I might eventually eclipse Michael Jan Friedman and take number two. Number one, at the current rate, out of reach. Never going to make it. I'll be dead before I can write that many more Star Trek books.
I knew you were going to say Peter David when you were talking about the most prolific Star Trek authors. I don't know if I'd ever heard someone like count them up before like that. I was like, oh yeah, it's got to be Peter David. He's written so many. But the last time that I guess we talked about your work on the show was a few years back. You wrote the first of the Discovery tie-in novels, Desperate Hours, in 2017.
Yeah.
That was a fun read because it was scratching that Pike itch. You know, we were all wondering like, oh, we have a 23rd century show. Like, show me Pike and Una and Spock on the Enterprise. And and you were like, here you go right here. The show's going to make you wait till season two, but I got you covered right here with the book.
Well, I was told the show was never going to go there.
Oh, interesting. So you're just like, it was like an open for you to do what you wanted.
I was hired to write that book, and I was asked specifically by Brian Fuller, the creator of Star Trek Discovery. He said, we're not going to be doing any stuff on the show with Pike or the Enterprise or Spock. He says, but you know, it's too important to ignore. So let's get it into the first tie-in book. And so the idea of having the Enterprise guest star in the first Discovery novel and have, you know, having it feature Pike and Spock and Una, that came from Brian Fuller. That was a direct request. Between the time when I fulfilled that request and wrote the book and turned it in. And when the book actually came out, Brian left the show, was replaced by two new showrunners. And the new showrunners had different ideas, which is why season one ends with the appearance of the Enterprise and the entrance of, you know, Pike and Spock and Una, who I was told weren't going to be there. Between that and changes they made in the pilot episode during final post-production that I didn't find out about until I saw it in a screening room in CBS headquarters in New York about maybe 2 days before premiere, I was told there was one set of circumstances that governed the death of Burnham's parents. And so I wrote, you know, depicted it from her point of view in the book based on what I'd been told by Brian Fuller, based on everything I had seen in all the scripts. Well, I turn in the book and, you know, months later I see the premiere, you know, in the screening room, and I see the scene and I realize that scene does not match the scene I was given. And I just sit there shaking my head going, God damn it, son of a bitch.
Yeah. That sounds like, you know, Trek canon in a nutshell sometimes.
It just runs roughshod over the books whenever it wants.
Yeah.
Just in general, like, you know, before we dive in, like, into kind of more specifics on Firewall, you know, I think that, you know, people in the fandom, it's, you know, it feels like a dream come true to imagine writing Trek novels. But of course, it's got its own pressures and complications and all the stuff like you were just talking about. What's, you know, how do you manage that? You know, is it, you know, are you?
I drink.
There you go. That's the solution.
Dr. McCoy style.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah. McCoy, my idol from a very early age. There you go.
Is that right?
No, it's actually Spock, but I drink like McCoy.
Actually, somewhat related. You know, we always like to ask, you know, what's your entry point? You know, anybody we talk to who is a professional with Trek in any capacity, where their entry point into the fandom was, or, you know, what their first Star Trek experiences were.
Well, look at the color of my beard and take a guess.
Were you there for OG?
I wasn't there when it first aired. I was born as it was ending. I was born in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
But I was there for the moon landing. I don't remember it, but I was there. Not on the moon, I mean, you know, just on Earth. But no, I was. I grew up watching Star Trek, the original series, in its original syndicated reruns through the early 70s. And I remember it being a really big deal when, you know, Star Trek the Motion Picture came out in 1979. So Star Trek was my first love fandom, imprinted on it from a very young age. And so the ethos, the idealism of Star Trek shaped my worldview, my belief that, you know, in what the world should be, how it should run, what the future should look like. That was all shaped by Star Trek from the very beginning. So I grew up with that. And then Next Gen came around when I was 18. It premiered as I went to film school. So just as I was embarking on screenwriting and learning filmmaking and directing and editing and all that, Star Trek had its revival. You know, it came back, it roared back to life with Next Generation. And all through my 20s, my young adulthood, then there was DS9, which I got to write for. Voyager, which I sold the story to, but for reasons that had nothing to do with the story, it ended up not being made. So I basically worked for Voyager and for DS9. And then after that, I just sort of transitioned into working for the books around the year 2000. So around the 90s, I was working for the shows. And then around 2000, I just sort of transitioned and started working for the books.
And, you know, for viewers who don't know, it was a couple fairly notable DS9 episodes. Father, you're going to remember the titles better than
Starship Down was the first one that I really like.
Is it It's Only a Paper Moon? Is
that That's correct. That's season 7.
Yeah.
The episode that my partner John and I sold to Voyager that ended up not being made would have been called Sick Bay if they hadn't changed.
But after you started working in doing like the Star Trek novels, you also like came back into some involvement with the TV shows though, because
after many years, yeah, it took a long time. First of all, I had to wait through that long desert when there was no Trek on TV from around the end of Enterprise until, you know, Discovery came back, and that's a long time. That's what, 12 years. 12 years.
Yeah,
you're like keeping the faith,
keeping the fire lit. You know, that's what I do. So, you know, I like to, you know, I have a, my buddy John likes to joke that, you know, I should have been a novelist all along. I like to say even now, well, I'm just doing this until I can get a TV writing gig. But yeah, I ended up when Discovery rolled around, since I was writing the first book, I was in the loop on all the scripts, the story development, all the plans, all the graphic design. So I was seeing everything. I was in the loop on all this stuff. And through my friend Kirsten Beyer, I had the opportunity to send back feedback. So I was essentially an uncredited, unpaid consultant on Discovery Season 1. And you would be shocked to find out just how much of my stuff got used, how much made it on screen, how much is still there.
Yep.
That came from me sending it to Kirsten and Kirsten walking it into the room. So it's fun.
That is very cool, although being paid is usually cool too.
I would have loved to have had the money.
Yeah.
The, like Kayla Detmer's name, like that came from your book. And now, like, it's funny, yeah. The other day I was talking about Discovery Season 5 with someone, and they were so worried about Detmer. They were saying, like, oh, Detmer doesn't show up in that latest trailer at all. Like, I hope she's okay. I hope she survives the season. And it's like, it's interesting. It's like, well, when they were making the show, they didn't even have like a backstory or anything. They didn't have like a name for that character. But, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And I had to go in and explain. I'm like, look, guys, that's fine for you while you're in development, but I have to start writing a novel. And unlike film, which has an exterior omniscient viewpoint, a neutral exterior sort of perception of the events, novels are written through the perceptions of characters. They are written with a subjective viewpoint. And these are people who serve together. They know each other. They know one another's names. They are friends. They are colleagues. They are not going to think of each other as helm officer and weapons officer. This is going to be your friend, Lieutenant so-and-so. So I said, these people need to have names. They need to have backstories. There needs to be something more about them than just a job description. So can I give these people names? What can I make up about them? And what they told me was, they said, well, we've already done preliminary casting, although they haven't been named yet. They sent me the actors' headshots. They said, this is the actor cast for this role. This actor will be sitting here at this station. This actor's over here. This actor's going to be, in the Daft Punk helmet. You know, this one's going to be here. This one's going to be there. So I went through and I just started giving them names. And I wrote up a page of backstory, a little bit about where they come from, what they're interested in, if they have some secret pain that they hide or some secret hobby that they love or whatever. And just to give them a little bit of humanity, that there was something to hang a hat on, something that you could either have informing subtext or, just anything that you might just come up at a moment. So I developed all that. Sent it to Kirsten for her approval. She got it approved by the showrunners. And then she asked the showrunners, could we share this with the actors? And the showrunner said, yeah, why not? Yeah, as long as the director doesn't, object. So Kirsten got permission from the director, showed it to the actors, said, all right, your name is Kayla Detmer. And here's some background on who you are and where you're from and what you like. And, and your name is Troy, and they said Januzzi, and it's supposed to be Januzzi, but nobody there knows how to pronounce Italian names for some reason. I don't know why. So they took what should have been Januzzi and turned it into Januzzi. I still don't know why. and so on and so forth. They changed a few. They wanted somebody else to have sort of a more white bread name over here. And I was like, all right, fine, well, whatever. But Cameron Gant made it in, and I named the Daft Punk officer. I think I named her Narwani, after a science fiction book editor who works here in New York. And so I gave all these characters names, histories, lives, relationships, interests. And this is something that an actor, even if it doesn't come up in the scene, in their head, it allows them to say, all right, I know who this person is. It allows them to step into the role and inhabit it and have it fleshed out. Suddenly, it's not just a job description and pushing buttons. Now the person has a name, a backstory. They know, like one of the guys knew his character, loves sailing on open water. That this is a guy who comes from, basically running he knows how to sail a catamaran. It tells him something about the guy he's playing. And he can have that in his head, informing his choices as an actor while he's working on set, without it interfering in anything he's doing. Actors just love to be able to do shit like that because it helps them find the humanity of the person they're playing.
Yeah, that's so much more than just like a name or a namelessness.
A job description. Tactical officer.
Yeah.
Well, after providing some consultation on Discovery. I know that you were very involved with the foundations of Prodigy, but did you have any involvement with Picard or Lower Decks or anything else, like in between Discovery and Prodigy?
Lower Decks, I was there as a consultant, mostly in name only. I didn't have the same degree of involvement that I had on Prodigy. Prodigy, I was working with the Hageman brothers right from the very beginning. I was working with them on developing the final pitch when they were making it to Alex Kurtzman. A lot of the stuff I suggested, helped inform some of the choices that they made. Like, they liked some of the stuff I suggested, and it got folded into the show concept. And so I had a lot of influence behind the scenes on some of the choices at Prodigy. Whereas at Lower Decks, by the time I saw the scripts, they'd already gone through network approval. And usually at that point, you're not supposed to be messing with the scripts unless there's something really, really serious. So it was pretty clear that they really did not want my input at Lower Decks. For some reason, they got strong-armed into hiring me, and they didn't seem to really enjoy it. So I only worked one season there, and I only worked one season at Prodigy because their budget got cut heavily for season two, and there was just no way to keep me on. They cut like half the writer's room, and they cut me and a couple other people.
They tried to cut the show.
They tried to cut the show, but the show will not die because it's just too damn good.
It really is.
And then as far as Picard, funny story there. Picard is one of those things where I was, virtually in the room. I was on the call, and a lot of other people were physically in a big room at one of the secret hideout offices, I think in Santa Monica. We were doing a big creative story meeting. This would have been back in like December of 2018, I think. And they were talking about trying to get Patrick Stewart back in the fold. And he was saying he didn't want to do the same old thing or this or that, but he'd done an interview in Vanity Fair saying if he was going to come back to Star Trek, it would have to be for something big, something epic that would involve all the crews. There would have to be huge stakes and this and that. And he made it sound like he wanted some big epic adventure thing. And I brought that up in the meeting when they were talking about how do we get Patrick Stewart to come back on board. I said, it sounds like, what he's describing sounds like my Star Trek Destiny trilogy. I said, it sounds like that's what he wants to do, even if he doesn't know it. And they said, what is it? And I said, it's three books I wrote back in 2008. It's the final end-all, be-all showdown between the Federation and the Borg. Two civilizations enter, only one civilization leaves. It's the Alpha and Omega of the Borg. You see how they were made, and you see how they end. And at the heart of it all is, all these different timey-wimey stories that interweave, and it's multi-crossover. You've got DS9, you got TNG, you got Enterprise-era stuff. They were like, okay, that sounds complicated, but it also sounds really cool. You and Kirsten work on that. So I got teamed up with Kirsten Beyer, and you'll see that there were, they were registering TV series trademarks around the time, and one of them was Star Trek Destiny.
Mm-hmm. I remember when that happened.
It was because of that meeting. And then I got put through the paces, at Kirsten's request. I was doing beat sheets. I spent like 2 or 3 months working with her, trying to figure out how we were going to boil down this complex trilogy into 8 to 10 episodes of television. Because they were talking about just doing it as like a one and done. Because at that time, they thought Stewart didn't want to sign on for multiple seasons. They thought they'd be lucky to get him for 8 or 10 episodes, period. They had no idea that you'd get him for 3 seasons. If they'd known that, it would have changed the whole equation. But what happened was we were working on that, and I guess the general premise was pitched to him, and he balked. He was saying this thing about how he didn't want to be back in a Starfleet uniform, and he didn't want to be back on a bridge, and he didn't just want it to be a TNG reunion, and this and that and the other thing. And he wanted something totally different, but he didn't know what he wanted. And at that point, that's when they brought in like Akiva Goldsman, they brought in Michael Chabon, they changed the whole concept. My name gets stripped off all the documents. And they come up with a new concept that they developed with Kirsten for what becomes Picard. And ironically, by the time they get to the third season of Picard, with the exception for the fact that they did manage to avoid, he did not get back in the uniform. He was very clear about not wanting to be back in uniform, but he was back on the bridge of the Enterprise, wasn't he? And it was a TNG season 8 reunion, wasn't it? And it was a big adventure. And what did it involve? It involved a fucking Borg. So I'm not saying, that maybe, I'm just saying.
That's some bittersweetness there, yeah.
I can live with that a lot easier than I can live with season 2 of Discovery, but You remember season two of Discovery, right?
Yeah, that was the Pike and Una and Spock season.
Oh, right.
What was the big bad?
Was that the Red Angel?
Red Angel that?
No, Red Angel was season one.
They have the Red Angel in season two.
What was
two
the big bad they had to fight?
Oh, the control. The control from Section 31.
Right, right. Where did that come from?
That was in the books. That was was it actually?
Who wrote that?
Was that Peter David?
It was not.
Oh, no.
That was a David Mack.
Oh, the other David, right? Yes, indeed. Oh. Yeah, so it is not just all fun and games of just getting to write every Star Trek thing you want and you just are magically in charge of Star Trek.
Yeah,
I forgot about the control stuff was taken from the novels, but I'm not surprised you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a different show then. Let's talk about Picard instead of Discovery. But with Firewall, it felt like you were given both like a lot of freedom, but also like a lot of obligation to explain the Fenris Rangers, since the shows bring them up, but then never explain anything at all other than the name, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they had their ideas about them. They just never really got a chance to explore them on the show. I think that they were sort of picturing them as like these wandering, roving bands, like almost like Robin Hood in the 24th or 25th century. You know, the 25th century equivalent of a Robin Hood gang. Except instead of Sherwood Forest, you've got, you know, whatever sector of space they're mucking about in. And so I was told, like, how would you like to do the story of how, when, where, and why Seven joins the Fenris Rangers? I said, would I? In fact, the first time those episodes aired, I think it was either Absolute Candor, which is, I believe, Picard season one, ep four.
Mm-hmm.
It was either during that or during Stardust City Rag, the following episode. During one of those, as soon as they established the existence of this thing called the Fenris Rangers, I pause the episode, pick up my phone, email my editor, say, I would like to write a Fenris Rangers novel. And she wrote back, yeah, you and everybody else. She said, nobody's writing Fenris Ranger novel right now. The show doesn't know yet what they want to do with them. They may want to do more. They haven't decided. Until then, we have to stay hands off. I'm like, oh, okay, fine, I'll wait. I waited 2 years, and then finally Picard is done, and they come back to me and they say, okay, the Picard is wrapped up. They haven't really done anything more with Fenris Rangers, and the folks at Secret Hideout are of the opinion that they're not likely to do anything significant with Fenris Rangers in the immediate future. We have been given a green light. Would you like to write the book? I said, sure. And so that was the mandate. It was tell the story of how, when, where, and why Seven goes from, you know, coming home with the Voyager crew, why does she end up with the Rangers, and how does it happen? And so for that, I looked to what little information we had been given in canon. And she only says a few bits about it ever. I think a couple things in season one, a few things maybe in season two or three. And her lines come down to something simple like, you know, I came back, tried to get into Starfleet. They said no. Janeway even threatened to resign over it. That didn't move them. So I went full Ranger, and that's how she puts it. This, so that. They tried to do this. Janeway pushed. They said, no. I said, screw you. I went full Ranger. I'm like, okay, so there seems to be a causal relationship here. This wasn't like, they said no, and then I dithered about for 5 years and then joined the Rangers. It was, no, they said, no, we don't want you. And I said, well, then screw you. And somehow I ended up in the Rangers. So I was like, okay, so there's clearly a connection between these events. And then I looked at what else we sort of knew about the Federation at that time. And I'm like, okay, so in 2378, when Voyager comes home, it's only 5 years after first contact. And the Federation is, well, a little touchy. I mean, they've, you know, within the last 5 years, the Borg Collective has walked right up to Earth and knocked and nearly blew the planet away. So people are a little touchy about the Borg. And Starfleet is a little touchy in particular about Seven of Nine when she's being put forth for a Starfleet commission or maybe a place at Starfleet Academy. They're looking at her disciplinary record on Voyager for the 4 years when she was traveling with them. There are at least three separate incidents where she used force to take control of the ship and tried to hand them over to the Borg Collective, or at least hand herself back. There is plenty of reason between that and other assaults she made on the Voyager crew. She was a discipline problem and a post-traumatic stress, you know, poster child, if ever there was one. There's a lot of reasons to be concerned. And what concerns the Federation government is when, you know, they say, well, we're going to have to revive her records. We thought she was dead. Here you go. Here's your ID. You're Annika Hansen. And she says, no, I'm 7 of 9. 7 of 9 is a Borg designation. You tell the Federation, yeah, my chosen name is that of your sworn mortal enemy. Yeah, that's going to be troubling. That's going to be a problem. Between that and you've got Borg implants on your face and your blood is full of nanoprobes, you're effectively a superhuman killing machine walking around. You could assimilate our technology, assimilate our ships. For all Starfleet knows, this was all part of a plan. Maybe she's a long-term infiltrator. Maybe this is what the Borg wanted all along, to walk, you know, a Trojan horse in through the front door. They don't know. They're rightly paranoid. Earth nearly got blown away 5 years ago. These people have to be careful. So they don't give her the job. And people say, well, why did Icheb get in when she didn't? Well, Icheb wasn't assimilated as long as she was. And from the point where he was liberated and was sort of put into the mix on Voyager, he was a model citizen. No acts of rebellion, no insurrection, no attacking the crew, no trying to hand them over to the Borg. He didn't hijack the ship at any point that we know of. He was a model cadet. And look at his name. He took back his name, Icheb. He didn't stay as like 4 of 16. He's Icheb. He has chosen a name that says, I am no longer Borg. Whereas 7 of 9 is saying, I am still Borg, or at least I still identify on some level. So there's cultural issues. There's pragmatic, you know, tactical issues, strategic issues. There's just paranoia. But then there's also just some intrinsic latent racism of it. I mean, humanity has clearly proved that by the late 24th, early 25th century, it's still not above making knee-jerk judgments. Look at how they treat synthetic intelligence, how they treat the synths. They wind up outlawing all synthetic artificial intelligence. They wind up outlawing Soon-style androids. They make incredibly bad social decisions, and they do them in some of the most reactionary ways. And so I looked at all that, and I said, that's all got to come into play. She's going to have to react to that. And then when you look at the fact that her Borg identity and the whole issue with her being deadnamed, which we saw in Picard season 3, 7 on many levels is iconic as, you know, she's an icon to the queer and trans community. Many aspects of her identity and her story could be seen as allegories for trans identity or queer identity and the sort of prejudice that they face in society. So I wanted to lean into that, especially since Picard firmly and canonically established that by 20 years after coming home, 7 has embraced her identity as a queer woman. So this is obviously an evolution that she went through. This is a change that had to take place at some point. And I sort of just said, all right, this is going to have to all be part of the journey. And I realized that what I was writing was not just a story of how she gets a new job, that what I was really being asked to write was a coming of age story. This is, you know, the coming of age. This is 7 of 9. Realizing she's never going to be welcome at the world she was told would welcome her. She's not going to be welcomed into Starfleet. She has to separate from the sort of surrogate mother figure that Janeway has been. And she's going to have to go out into the world, find out, establish her own identity, find her own place, find her own path, find a job, find a place to live, find a purpose in life. And she's going to have to find a place that accepts her for her. And that's something that, you know, I think is universal, and it's something we all have to go through at some stage. At some point, you know, you leave behind adolescence, you move into adulthood, and part of that is you have to sort of separate what your parents want for you and figure out what you want for yourself. And you've got to leave the safe shelter that they provide you. And at some point, you just have to go out into the deep end of the pool and swim. And you're on your own. And that's what this story is about. It's about 7 going out there at long last and just making her own way.
This is, I think, a good example of like what the books can be so good at is capturing a little bit more of that internal life and adding some nuance to, you know, it's not just Starfleet is the heavy, they're the bad guys, and, you know, just reactionary, that they've got some, you know, reasonable thoughts on this matter. There is some latent racism for sure. And, yeah, that was. I think that's going to be exciting for a lot of people to see that journey,
and a very relatable one.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's interesting because, you know, 7 is fits into that Trek category of these somewhat outsider characters like Spock or Data, who often have been stand-ins for people who are neurodivergent or just have any sort of social awkwardness or whatever. And so that's it's an interesting both quality and responsibility, I think, to writing them.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
Something I noticed is that the books can push a little bit more boundaries sometimes than the movies or TV. And now, not necessarily, Picard and Discovery were getting they could drop an F-bomb. They could get a little bit more out there. But you've got a little bit more leeway. There's an incident early on where Seven finds some anti-Borg graffiti, and it's pretty profane and pretty intense. And I thought that hit hard and good. It was meant to hurt a bit. It was meant to sting, and going the little bit extra mile with the profanity felt fitting.
Well, it wasn't that it was that shocking a word. It's just that seeing that sentiment expressed on Earth in the 24th century is what's shocking. It's the fact that
right
at the beginning of the book, she's staying at this, house, this beach house down in South Africa outside Cape Town. And Janeway comes to visit her. And Janeway's trying to figure out, she's telling Janeway, I'm leaving Earth. And Janeway's like, why? Why do you feel you have to leave? And Sam says, let me show you something. And she walks her outside and shows her the side of her house that faces inland. And someone has graffitied her house with "Die Borg Bitch." And it's the hostility of the sentiment. It's the violence intrinsic in it. That's what makes it shocking. It's not even really the profanity of it. It's the clear violence of the intent. That's what makes it sort of just unsettling. And that's when she points this out to Janeway and says, the local constabulary shows no particular interest in solving this. Is it any wonder then that Seven doesn't feel safe? She doesn't feel welcome. This is not going to be home. This is not a place where she can be the best version of herself.
Well, this is a good opportunity to talk about she finds a sort of surrogate crew, a new crew, I guess, in the form of the Rangers. And you get to introduce some new characters. Let's see. Harper is her train her. There is a love interest and co-ranger in Ellery, I think.
Ellery Cade.
Yeah. Do you want to just like tell us just a little brief thing about some of the Rangers that fit into this mix?
Well, as you said, Keon Harper, who I modeled after Jeff Bridges in The Old Man, the FX series, The Old Man. He is her mentor. He's the one who walks her into the Rangers, sponsors her, basically, her application, because she saves his ass. She's told to spy on him and infiltrate the Rangers, but she sees he's walking into an ambush, and she is, in many ways, the daughter that Janeway raised her to be. She can't see a guy like this going into certain death and not do anything to help him, so she blasts her way in and saves his neck. And, he's more than a little grateful, and he thinks, maybe she'd make a hell of a good Fenris Ranger. And Seven starts to think maybe she would. So he walks her in, and the first thing, one of the first people she meets when they arrive at Ranger headquarters on Fenris, she meets Ellery Cade, and it's like this electric love at first sight kind of a moment. The soundtrack that'd be playing in both their heads would be Crimson and Clover by Joan Jett. So, there's clearly an electric potential connection between Ellery and Seven at first meeting. And then they meet some of the other Rangers, like Lucan Sagasta. He's described as dark-skinned with a big, bright, white Cheshire Cat smile. He's the hotshot, the daredevil, the joker, the ladies' man. You've got Jalen Parr, who is Ellery's partner when we first meet them. He's Bajoran. He's sort of a good, reliable, stand-up guy. You've got a half-Cardassian woman, I believe, named Rana. And then there's a few others. There's Spears, who is kind of just a good go-getter. I based him on the character of Spears in Band of Brothers. Basically with this whole little troop of Fenris Rangers, and it becomes her newfound family. Because what happens in life, very often, psychologists have shown that you go out and you either set up a family unit that resembles the one you grew up with if you liked it, and if you hated it, you find a family unit or you create a family unit that is different. Well, Seven had acclimated to her found family unit on Voyager. She liked it. She liked the emotional safety net that it gave her. But when they came back to Earth, everybody scattered. Janeway gets promoted to an admiralty position. She's the only one that stays involved in Seven's life. Tom and B'Elanna go off to have their kid. The doctor goes off on his speaking tour about holographic sentient rights. Harry finally gets his long delayed promotion and gets a starship posting. Tuvok gets a position in Starfleet, security, and so on and so forth. And then the thing that breaks her up with Chakotay is that at the same time, the Federation won't make her a citizen and Starfleet won't let her in. He gets promoted. He becomes a captain and gets put in charge of the Protostar project, which is ultra classified, total top secret. And she's been shut out. So she's filled with all this envy and resentment. He was a goddamn McKee, and he's now in charge of the Protostar. But her, you know, probably one of the most capable people ever to walk in their front door, she can't get a job. And all this toxicity builds up. She's got, you know, envy, resentment, justifiable anger. And even though it's not his fault, as she describes it in the book, this anger and this resentment and the envy causes her to self-sabotage that relationship, and she torpedoes it. Which is, you know, basically it breaks them up because she can't take that he's gotten this fantastic assignment while she's being shut out and treated like a pariah. It's one of those things where obviously they're operating in two different circles of life and they're just not going to be able to be together anymore. And she's just pissed about it. She's just pissed, and rightfully so. Well, she recreates that family unit when she gets to the Rangers. Instead of a surrogate mother figure like she had in Janeway, she now has Harper, her training officer, mentor, whatever you want to call him. Well, he becomes like a surrogate father figure to her. And then, you know, there's even a line late in the book when she's talking with Ellery and trying to explain, you know, why she, you know, still thinks that someday Starfleet will come around and do the right thing. She's explaining that these people were like family to her. And Ellery tries to explain, well, you've got a new family. You have hundreds of new brothers and sisters on Fenris who are waiting to welcome you home right now. As you are, as the person you are, you shouldn't have to wait your whole life to be validated by Starfleet and the Federation. If they're not going to treat you with respect, if they're not going to welcome you as you, the person you are, and value you for you, well, then why are you spending so much energy on them when we're willing to welcome you as you are right now? And that's the argument that eventually sways Seven.
And it's not like the Fenris Rangers, they're kind of upper ranks. They have some concerns about bringing in a Borg too, but they're, you know, the mainstay of their force is just pretty instantly accepting of her.
That made for some fun tension, by the way, with Harper having the condition of, okay, if you're going to bring in this Borg into the Rangers, you have to keep an eye on her. And if she gets Borgy, it's going to be up to you to drop her, you know? So that's kind of some fun tension to
add
in there.
But he's also, at some point, like after that, he gets to sort of point out, he's like, she's put her ass on the line more times than I can count. She's only been here, like, what, 5 days? She saved my ass on this planet. She saved Ellery here. She saved somebody else here. She's like, she puts her ass on the line repeatedly to save complete strangers. Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't that our entire job description? And they have to sort of look at him and go, yeah.
As you're describing that, I'm picturing Jeff Bridges playing Harper, like giving that speech, you know. I picture the actor as the character now.
I wrote all his dialogue within my head, Jeff Bridges doing the line delivery, and it was just a joy. I picture him as Harper, and for the love interest of Ellery Cade, I picture Jessica Henwick, who you might remember as Colleen Wing in Iron Fist. Bugs, the girl with blue hair in Matrix Resurrections, or
yeah,
I love Henwick. She has this sort of effervescent, slightly awkward, goofy charm, and even though she's a complete knockout, she somehow still manages to play like the slightly weird, off-kilter girl next door. I don't know how she does it, but it's just the most charming damn thing in the world.
You know, sort of related to other media, I saw that you had put together a playlist to accompany it, that where you've got some songs that are like pop songs with lyrics and some instrumental for action scenes and or dramatic tension. Is music kind of a part of your process? Do you listen while you're writing? Is that a...
Yeah, big part of the process. I use it to either get into the right headspace and stay in the right headspace. Depending on what I'm writing, if I'm writing Trek and I'm writing a particular series, if I'm writing in the original series era, I might listen to my collection of original series music. Also, if I'm listening to, you know, if I'm writing a Vanguard story, which is set in that era, I'll listen to that. If I'm working in movie era, I've got the movie soundtracks. I've got show soundtracks for TNG, DS9, Voyager. Then I've got like, you know, the new ones. I've got some of the Picard soundtrack. I've got Discovery. So I collect all those. Then I collect movie soundtracks. And if I'm writing a big action sequence where I'm trying to conceptualize an action sequence for a book, often what I'll do is I'll buy some new movie soundtracks by composers I know I like. People like Christopher Lennertz, who did the Lost in Space soundtracks for Netflix. Lauren Balf, who has done the music for the last few Mission Impossible movies, as well as the His Dark Materials series for HBO. And I'll just listen to that, and I'll find like a particularly evocative piece of music. And in my head, I can separate it from what it was used for on TV, and I will now choreograph and build new action sequences using the music as a guide, and then I can get that onto paper. But what was different about the experience of writing Firewall is that a lot more pop music, particularly punk rock, came into play here. The attitude of the book is very punk, and particularly the scenes where Seven is, you know, sort of interacting in the club near the beginning of the story, where she meets a one-night stand, and you know, she's finding solace in the mosh pit, but also just sort of finding the key into her headspace. I was finding that a lot of it in the music of a band, an Australian punk band called Amyl and the Sniffers, who are just amazing. The lead vocalist, a woman named Amy Taylor, I believe, she's been described as a human firework, and it's pretty apropos. So the band in the that's featured in the club in the book is called Amyl's Nightrate, and they're clearly modeled on Amyl and the Sniffers. And so that, and you know, I found like a lot of different pop songs that sort of clued me into where Seven is. Like U2 Running to Stand Still really kind of captures Seven's sense of ennui at the beginning of the story when she's living on Earth and she doesn't see any purpose to staying there. She can't figure out how she's going to, you know, make a life here. And so, you know, lines like, you know, you gotta, you know, scream without raising your voice. That's where she is. She has all this pent up rage that she wants to express and she can't. She's in a place where she can't raise her voice. So she's got to get out. And then she finds like this haven, you know, in this queer punk bar, you know, on this beat up, you know, planet, you know, in the city of Starheim. And it's a mosh pit. And, you know, she finds, you know, the woman who at one point, while trying to be taught to dance, nearly broke somebody's arm on Voyager, figures out that the place for her is a mosh pit. It's like, yes, finally, a place that makes sense to her. And she realizes the mosh pit is not about hurting people. It's actually a strangely protective environment. It looks violent and chaotic from the outside, but inside, the moshers protect each other. If somebody falls, the other moshers pick them up. They don't step on them. There's a weird kind of a collective, you know, attitude that goes on inside the mosh pit, which she finds comforting. It's a place where you can be anonymous. You can vanish into the chaos and just become part of it. And she loves that. Suddenly she's found a place where she can just be her. And a lot of that sort of journey, that part of her journey, I found in the music. And then in particular, to sort of summarize the journey that she goes on, if the beginning of her journey is U2's Running to Stand Still, the conclusion of her journey is Joan Jett's Bad Reputation. That's a song that's just like her, gives absolutely zero. Can I swear on the show or not?
Yeah, go for it.
She gives absolutely zero fucks.
Hell yeah.
And Bad Reputation is exactly where she is at the end of the story. She's going to live life her way by her code, and she's not going to let anybody shame her for what she, you know, irrevocably is. She's not going to let any fucker tell her she doesn't know her own name, and she's not going to let somebody tell her that she has to live by their moral code instead of hers. She is, and if that gives her a bad reputation, so be it. She is Fenris Ranger 7 of 9, and if you don't like it, you can suck it.
But I do really enjoy the arc of how the book opens. It does feel like, oh, this is the Seven at the end of Endgame, Voyager Season 7. And then you get to the end of the book, and it totally naturally feels like, okay, we've come to the, what the hell, Picard, you owe me a ship, you know, Seven, that we meet in Picard.
You owe me a ship, Picard.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like we have to touch on the action side of this, because, like, she... when Seven cuts loose, it is like when Data goes into action or something like that. This is what Starfleet missed out on in their bad decision, is that she can be extremely effective in like combat situations. And they have you've set up a very nasty foe, a sort of local, very nasty warlord with big Trek level scale to his kind of grip over a sector.
Yeah. An Antican, no less. That was good use of the universe, bringing back the Antican species.
The funny thing is, I mean, in the end, as a tactical opponent, he's not really a match for her. What is daunting to her about him is that he has money, he has resources, he's got layers of protection around him that make it hard for her to, you know, get at him and bring him to justice. And what really thwarts her about him is the fact that, you know, he represents a moral assault to her. It's the pure, unadulterated evil of the things he does. And what's odd about, well, not really odd, but it's sort of ironic in that some of the evil he does is part of what eventually breaks her free from her sort of slightly stilted emotional place where she is at the beginning of the book, like where we find her at the end of Voyager, where she's still grappling with human empathy as a concept. What breaks her through is when Ellery shows her what's left of this colony that this warlord has wiped out. And she's showing her this dry river gully, which has the sun bleached, dried out bones of 80,000 murdered people lining this gully. This is what breaks Seven emotionally. It's like suddenly, you know, she collapses. She's on her knees in front of it, and she lands on it with enough force that the bones crumble under her. Now she's got this filthy, greasy ash, like blood on her hands. And this is the moment where you can't look away anymore. This is basically confronting, you know, a war crime, a genocide, and you've got it on your hands. And suddenly she is in touch with all of her guilt about all the things that she was used by the Borg collective to do. She has to ask herself, is this the kind of monster that I am? Is this what I was? And then she's also just hit by the wave of empathy. It's like suddenly empathy, this concept that she has found so difficult to wrap her head around and open herself up to, just runs her over like a goddamn truck. She has that moment of insight. This one life is the same as my life. It's just as valuable. But if I can say that about one, I can say it about 10. If I can say it about 10, I can say it about 100, 1,000, 100,000, 1,000,000. And suddenly, there it is. The floodgates are open at the worst possible goddamn moment. It's like, if you're going to have the moment where you have the final awakening to empathy, try not to do it at the scene of essentially a Holocaust-level massacre. But that's where it hits her. And fortunately, she's got Ellery Cade to pull her back from the edge. But it's also what sets her, gives her a sense of mission. She now sees the kind of evil that she's up against, and it gives her that sense of mission. I must find the source of this evil, and I must crush it.
Yeah, it radicalizes her. Radicalization.
Yeah, it radicalizes her. She says, this is what I'm fighting. So it's great in that respect. So that's what wakes up her empathy and sort of catapults her. This is, you know, the big moment. This is the transformative moment that changes her from who she was in Voyager to who she's going to become in Picard. Not as much as, say, the tragedy of losing Icheb is eventually going to, but in terms of opening her up to her humanity and leading her into a new phase of her life, and making up for all the lost time that the Borg took away from her. They took her childhood, her adolescence, and her young adulthood. The years we all take for granted when we're figuring out our lives, who we are, who we like, what we like. She lost all of it. And at 32, she's got to start from scratch and figure out her self-identity and everything else. I mean, she's got quite an uphill fight.
Yeah, and then she has like a shitty job at the Amazon factory she's got to deal with too. So
yeah, but it's still a little collective-y ish, just enough to get her by.
Feels like being back in a Borg cube. She likes the anonymity. Mm-hmm. She likes the symmetry and the precision of all the moving parts of the machine. It's predictable. But again, what she doesn't sort of realize is that she's not making progress, that she's simply repeating old patterns. It's almost like being back in the recharge alcove, but different. And this is not progress, but she's not seeing it yet. Just as like the one night stand with the girl she meets in the bar, she's striving, she's yearning for connection, for intimacy, for something real. And she's finding something tawdry, something temporary, something that is not satisfying. It's verging on self-harm, but again, she doesn't see it yet. She senses something's wrong, but she can't name it. Until she finds something better, she's not going to realize what it is that's wrong with what she's got.
That is a deep dive into the character. Did you need to do any prep for it? Did you rewatch Voyager? Did you feel immersed enough?
I had to rewatch a bunch of episodes of Voyager. I had to sort of go through all the stuff that all the research that had been compiled upon her in Memory Alpha, Memory Beta. I conferred heavily with Kirsten Beyer, who is the co-creator of the Picard TV series, but for a long time was the writer in charge of the Voyager books, the post-finale era Voyager books. And so she had written a lot of stories involving Seven and Janeway. And so she knew these characters really, really well. She's very invested in them for all the years she put in on the novels. And then, of course, as the co-creator of the Picard series and that incarnation of Seven, I mean, who better? So she vetted my story outline and she gave me some feedback. And she and I talked at length about, you know, what did we see as being Seven's journey, you know, and how does she want Seven depicted? Some of the things that changed from early drafts was that originally Seven, you know, was, you know, had a body count by the end of this thing. And Kirsten said, that's not who she is. This is the protege of Janeway. She's going to be more heroic and we don't want to see her taking lives. She's not the killer that we're going to see in Picard because Icheb hasn't been killed yet. That moral line is something Seven doesn't want to cross yet. And we don't want her to cross it. I said, okay. And that note, although it would have seemed like the sort of thing that would be like, you know, tying one's hands, in fact, led to one of the best, you know, decisions that I had in the book. When she's being attacked, you know, near the end of the book, in one of the big climactic action sequences, the original idea was it was going to be her up against a bunch of commando types. I'm like, but how does she get out of that without actually killing these guys? And I'm like, well, okay, then don't have her fighting flesh and blood. Put her up against something even more brutal. Get the incarnation of like everything she doesn't want to be anymore, the machine part of herself, the Borg. Create these drones that are basically Borg killers, gigantic rhinoceros-sized, you know, mechanical spiders that have been designed by the Federation to specifically wipe out Borg, and put her up against four of them. It's like sending four tanks to kill a cop. I'm like, this is beautiful. This is overkill. It's a mechanized foe, so she's free to damage and destroy them at will. And also by externalizing this foe, this very cold, brutal, mechanical foe, it's everything that she has come to hate about herself externalized, and this is what she's fighting. So it was one of those things where this sort of seeming restriction, she doesn't kill anybody, suddenly led to, my God, this is a beautiful, poetic way to address thematically, you know, the fight of her life. And so we really sort of dug into that. We dug into her relationship with Janeway. And originally there was a lot more antagonizing, more antagonism between her and Janeway, a lot more animosity by Seven towards Starfleet. And again, it was Kirsten who said, no, let's walk that back. You know, she has a very good relationship with Janeway. It wouldn't deteriorate this quickly. And she's not going to sour that heavily on Starfleet that quickly. She should have some resentment, but not total hatred. She's not going to be, you know, totally suddenly anti-Starfleet. I said, those are good points. And so what we have is a more nuanced disagreement, a philosophical disagreement between Janeway and Seven. Janeway does not see the Fenris Rangers as a noble calling. She has, you know, because of her Federation background, her Starfleet training, her Starfleet experience, she accepts the Federation's line on the Rangers, which is they're illegitimate. They're basically vigilantes. They can't be trusted, yada, yada, yada. And Seven is saying, no, they're not what you say they are. They are better than that. They can be worked with. And this, you know, basically comes down to a case where, just as, again, most of us find out at some point in life, what you want to do with your life and what your parents want you to do with your life sometimes are not the same thing. And at some point, assuming adulthood, you know, making that transition from being their child to being your own adult is the point where you say, I understand your objections, but it's my life, it's my choice, and I'm doing it my way, and you're just going to have to trust me. And if you love me, you'll trust me. And that's what it comes down to with Janeway and Seven. And finally, Janeway is able to accept that. She's able to say, you're right. I may not like the Rangers, but I do trust you, and I will trust you now. And that's where they leave it, where they have evolved from a hierarchical relationship of a surrogate mother and, say, a surrogate daughter, to where they're now equals who can call each other by their first names. They have now become equals in the playing field of life. And that's, again, part of the coming of age story as you go from being the child to being the adult.
That's pretty Star Trek, too.
It is.
And I really enjoyed those scenes between the two of them. The voices really came through. It felt like the characters from the shows. There's some other familiar faces from Star Trek shows that pop up in the book.
A few Prodigy characters pop in.
I was excited by some of the DS9 characters too, and we love Prodigy here. But yes, a certain rival of Cisco's has an appearance, and yeah. I was very excited about that one.
Is very much in character from
a rival of Cisco.
Yes, maybe the Vulcan, a sporting rival.
Solor Solok.
Solok.
Oh yeah, the Vulcan
captain.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I brought him back. Yeah, you're right. That is I forgot, but you're right. That is where I got him. That is a deep cut.
Yeah, I was.
And he's still a prick. So still very much in character.
Very much a prick, but he's a prick who can justify his prickiness.
The Vulcans seem to have an ability in that sometimes.
They have a gift.
With the characters that you created, though, like I don't want to give anything away about, you know, who makes it out of the book, who doesn't. People should go read it. It's a lot of fun, but it does kind of feel like there is sequel potential with this book. I'm sure the dude who, as soon as he heard the word Fenris Rangers, is on the phone with his editor, like, can I write that book, please? I'm sure that there are plans in your head for more of these characters.
I wouldn't say plans. I don't have any plans to write a sequel to it or even pitch a sequel to it. I would want to try something else my next time out. I'd love to get a Strange New Worlds book if that was possible. But if the editors came back and said, this, worked out really great, or, the sales on this were terrific and the critical response was great, we'd like another Fenris Rangers 7 story. Well, then, yeah, sure. I'd go and I'd try to think up something that was worth doing as a follow-up to this. It would have to be very different. Part of what I loved about this story is the fact that there is something really iconic about it that makes it a standalone. You don't need to read anything before it or after it or during it to get it. It simply is. If you've seen the end of Voyager and you've seen Picard, you got enough and you can just jump in. And this is a story that I think everybody gets on some level. It's about growing up. It's about leaving home. It's about figuring out who you are and what you want to be in life and overcoming the obstacles that stand between you and the life you want to live and the person you want to be. A sequel to that? Not impossible. I have no idea what that would be. But if somebody comes to me from the publisher and says, we want you to write it and here's a stack of money, then I say, okay. And I'll get on that and I'll have you an outline in 3 weeks.
That's my interesting. Job, and
that's what they pay me for. And I know, obviously, we say we don't want to give any spoilers about who lives, who dies, who doesn't. But I will say, I know that there are some tropes that queer readers of science fiction and fantasy have come to dread, especially when they hear about a story like this. One is called Bury Your Gaze, where you introduce the queer characters, and then they just all seem to wind up dead by the end of the story. That does not happen here. There is no Bury Your Gaze. There's another particularly annoying trope where the interesting, fun sidekick character of color is always the one who has to die to show that the situation is serious. No, not here, not this time. We do not kill Luke and Sagasta. He is the cool sidekick character of color. He's awesome, and he lives. He comes through pretty much unscathed. I'll tell you that right now. Because that's the kind of book it is. And you're going to get to a moment in the book, I'm not going to tell you which one or where it is, and you're going to say, Mac, you son of a bitch, you lied to me. You said you weren't going to do this. I'm going to walk you right up to the line. You're going to swear to God I've lied to you. And then you're going to look at it and you're going to go, oh, no, he kept his promise. Okay, good. All right. Okay, sure. Right, but I'm going to walk you right up to the line.
Well, Seven of the Rangers subvert Starfleet expectations a little bit, you've got to subvert reader expectations.
Yeah. But also, I have to understand that there are certain tropes that are hurtful mm-hmm. to the community, and which had no place here. And the other thing too is you go to all this trouble to, you know, have the queer characters find a love interest, and somehow they always wind up with some tragic story that ruins it by the end. Again, at the same, you know, at the risk of spoiling the story for folks, again, that doesn't happen here. Relationships between different characters can end for all sorts of reasons. Not everybody always has to die to end a relationship, although that does seem to happen a lot in Trek. But there are lots of reasons why they can end, but there's also plenty of reasons why they can just keep going. And in this one, the relationship they get to have there, it's maybe not happily ever after, but they definitely get happy for now.
Yeah, yeah, I like that.
And I don't think anybody would accuse it of being like pie in the sky or anything, because we see Seven searching and going through her pains and stuff along her path. But yes, I think we're going to all appreciate Trek being more thoughtful and nuanced in its treatment of the queer community. And so I'm hoping the book will find this audience too.
So far, the response I've seen from members of the community who have read it and have reviewed it have been very positive. They've felt pretty good about it. I'm hoping that will continue to be the case. I guess we'll find out. I guess we'll see.
That's exciting to hear. David Mack, is there anything else you want to tell us about Firewall?
No, I think we've covered a lot of it. It was just that, damn, it was a heck of a writing experience. It was a very deep dive. And I hope that readers of all backgrounds, all persuasions, dig into this and just feel that I've captured something true, something essentially human about Seven and her journey. As long as we find that there's something emotionally true in it, then I'll feel like I've done my job. And I hope that that's how readers feel.
Remind me, it had a very lovely like dedication at the beginning. The book was dedicated to,
for everyone who's ever been made to feel like an outcast and has become stronger and better for it.
And there you go.
And at the end of the book, if you look in the acknowledgments, you'll see that I do say specifically for all the members of Star Trek's LGBTQ community, this book's for you guys with love and respect.
That seems like a good note. Shall we wrap it there, Father E?
Sure. Thank you so much. Say goodbye, Star Trek author David Alan Mack.
Bye, guys. Thanks for having me on. It's been great.
So that was a lot of fun. If y'all end up picking up Firewall, please reply or talk to us in the Discord and let us know how you felt about it. We would love to keep the conversation going.
Yeah, I saw several people in our comments getting kind of pumped up for it. Or Aaron's already he's doing some reading on it, so he's gonna be going through it.
Yeah, and Seven of Nine's like a character like I grew up with as like. She's like one of my favorites of all time, sure. Just on Voyager. And so it was fun for me to, I don't know if I've read several Star Trek novels over the years, but I don't know. I haven't read like a ton of like Voyager novels. I don't know if I've ever read something that was so Seven centric. So it was just a fun experience getting to live in one of my favorite characters' heads for a few hundred pages. And it was a,
yeah, I was particularly happy with, the voice for Janeway, you know, kind of some of the same reasons, you know, David Mack mentioned, you know, that she didn't feel like, I was a little worried that in setting Seven against her, that she was going to kind of get punked out, she would have to be the bad moral.
Yeah. She would have to be too big of a dick. And
right. And so yeah, it was very cool for me to see her. I thought again, her voice really came through. Everything yeah. I heard there felt like something I could really hear Janeway saying. And yet, you know, these characters still, you know, there's some clashes. But yeah, that was one of the things I really liked about it.
Well, I want to give a big thank you and shout out to all the lovely Text Trek Patreon supporters who make the weekly live show possible. So that's going to be Starfleet, Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Dog, Geek Filter, Old Grey Trekkie, Quark Spar, Stephanie Durantas, Braxton, Chuck A, Joel Morrison, and our anonymous supporters. Thank each and every one of you so much. And did I add Matthew Averett back in there? But if not, Matthew Averett, also back in the patrons. And next week, Dave and I, we will begin our road to Disco Season 5. The final year of Discovery is almost upon us. Just a month away, so.
Is this is this where we'll be discussing the previous season?
Or, yes.
Yes.
We never did like a big like season 4. Let's just talk about like the entire season as one whole thing because we were so busy in 2020. When was that even out? 2023?
Oh my God. Who can remember?
2022, yeah.
A pandemic happened.
Disco season 4 was 2022. That's the last time we've talked about it. But there was so much Trek that year.
Yeah,
we're going to talk about season 4, and then we'll be hyping up season 5. We need to do like a trailer breakdown at some point. I don't know. Do people want that as the trailer? As the trailer's been out so long, do people still need that?
There's like 3 trailers, or I feel like I've seen like 3 clips at least.
There was like a new trailer just a few days ago. You might not have seen that one.
I've watched it once, but I was kind of trying, even for me, to not absorb too much because, you know, we're coming up on it. I'd rather not recognize a scene and be like right before something happens to remember, oh yeah, this is the thing from the trailer. So I'm sort of trailer embargoing a little bit, but obviously I'm fine with, you know, if we decide we want to do a little bit of a deeper dive on it, you know, we can do that.
But there will be a live stream probably Monday night. If Sohail's in the live audience, so he can tell us if that'll work or not, but if anyone wants to hear a Star Trek Cruise 2024 breakdown, I can do that with Sohail Monday night, and otherwise we'll be back on the show as usual Friday at 7 p.m. Central, and available to listen to on podcast platforms anywhere, and maybe some reports from the Discovery premiere at South by Southwest coming up in a few weeks. We're still trying to sort things out. I don't know. Maybe we'll be there, maybe we won't be. But that is premiering on March 11th. So that's 10 days away from day of recording. So like the day this is out on podcast platforms, it'll be a week away.
Right.
And Sohail says people are asking for these videos. So I guess there will be a cruise breakdown on Monday. And at some point after that, a final Disco trailer breakdown. And then a look back on Disco Season 4 with Dave, me, and we're going to try to have at least one other person with us. So I'm looking forward to getting back in the Disco headspace, though. I haven't watched much Discovery lately just because we haven't been talking about it. So it'd be fun just to rewatch
those characters. That's one of the cool things with Trek is there's a lot of different flavors of Trek, even within the broad scope of it. And when you've kind of been away from one of them for a little while, you'll find yourself thinking, like, I could use a bite of that. That's where I am with Disco.
Well, I am going to get back in the Disco chair and say, Black Alert, let's fly, and get my Disco rewatch on. So I'm going to run off and do that. But I hope everyone else has a great rest of your day. And until next time, as always, live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek. And follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.